Reflections for Highly Effective People by Dr. Stephen R. Covey.
Daily Reflections of Highly Effective People. Hello, I'm Stephen Covey. The purpose of this Reflections program is to help you become strong in the hard moments. You see, in every day are found a few hard moments, which if we are truly strong in, make everything else a piece of cake. But if we are weak in those moments, if we cave into the temptation of taking the lower road, then we will find ourselves caving in on many things. Shakespeare put it this way: "There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures." There are hard moments in each of the seven habits. Let me briefly share what some of them might be. Many of the hard moments of Habit 1, Be Proactive, involve subordinating a mood, a temporary feeling, or a circumstance to a principle or guideline you value. As I related in the Seven Habits book, one of the most profound, truly inspirational experiences of my life took place in the fall of 1969 when I was on a sabbatical leave in Hawaii to write a book. I was rummaging around the stacks in the library on the campus that I had an office in. I pulled down a book which foolishly I never recorded. But I remember what it said as distinctly today as the first time I read it. It literally staggered me. I read it again and again that day, and I returned several days in a row to reflect on it. It said essentially this: between stimulus and response is a space. In this space lies our freedom to choose our response. In these choices lie our growth and our happiness. In the most fundamental sense, Habit 1 is the awareness of this space between stimulus and response. In other words, between what has happened to us and our response to it. Next to life itself, this self-awareness and our freedom to choose, that is, to direct our lives, is our most precious gift and power. The hard moment or test of Habit 1 is to be aware of and to choose to live your own life. It is seeing yourself as the programmer, not as a program being acted out. Regardless of the social and psychic scars you may carry inside, regardless of how others treat you, regardless of the disappointments and strains and setbacks which may blindside your finest intentions, you see the space between all of that and your freedom and power to choose and respond to it. Habit 2, begin with the end in mind, is the habit of vision, of purpose, of mission. It is a sense of what your life is about and how you want to live it. It includes the principles and guidelines you want to live by. It's also not just your values, for values without vision are insufficient. Yes, we all want to be good, but good for what? We want to be good for something. What is that something? What is that vision? Not just for your whole life, but for today, this meeting, this interaction, this hour, this program. For many, the test or hard moment for Habit 2 comes when you are tired and lazy, just going with the flow. Some new project or meeting or day begins and you simply do not do the mental, emotional, and spiritual work inside to get a sense of how you would like it to end up. This doesn't mean that you decide all the exact details of how you want the meeting or day to end up, but rather you do decide what you want the spirit of that day or meeting and the quality of the relationship to end up like. You feel deeply committed to worthy end results, and yet no action has yet been taken. Habit 3, put first things first, is the habit of integrity, of discipline, of keeping that commitment. It is the habit that draws upon the independent will to literally act upon those things which we in habit 2 determine are the first things. You see, the hard moments of habit 3 come at us constantly. Will we carry forth our resolve? Will we execute? The deeper the resolve, the easier the execution, and vice versa. For instance, perhaps the most powerful form of minority vocal control ever contemplated takes place when a few million taste buds are screaming, yes, yes, to something you shouldn't eat, when at the same time billions and billions of unvocal cells in the rest of the body are crying out, no, no. This, frankly, is one of my hardest moments. It usually takes place at the end of the day when I'm on a trip all alone in a hotel room. I'm totally spent and exhausted from speaking all day and then traveling several hundred miles to a new location. I'm relaxed on the bed, talking on the phone to my wife and kids, simply letting it all hang out. But before the call home, I call room service. I can order anything I want. This is a hard moment. When I fail this hard moment, I live with the consequences of not sleeping as deeply, of putting on unnecessary girth, of not having the same energy the next afternoon. I then also have the feeling that I have betrayed my integrity and my stewardship to model what I teach and to champion other people's growth around the same principles. True minority control. What is your hardest moment for each of the first three habits? They are usually always different and very unique to every person. There is great value in trying to identify them so that you can exercise your unique endowments of self-awareness and independent will to live by your vision and conscience. There is also great value in recognizing the horrendous price we pay, both personally and socially, when we are weak in the hard moments. It's like trading diamonds for dust. Shakespeare beautifully captured the effects of giving in to the pleasure of the moment rather than subordinating it to the real joy of contribution and growth. He said this, "What win I if I gain the thing I seek? A dream, a breath, a froth of fleeting joy? Who buys a minute's mirth to wail a week? Or seeks eternity to get a toy? For one sweet grape, who will the vine destroy?" Perhaps the hardest moment and test of habit 4, think win-win, occurs when we are absolutely convinced we are right. We know exactly what should be done. We know what the decision should be and what we want. It's going for win-win when all you really want is your own way. Simply winning. Or perhaps it's going for win-win when another takes you on and opposes you, and you are so stirred up that you want to go for win-lose. You see it as a contest of wills. You don't want to give in. Or perhaps the hard moment is when you are threatened with the possibility of displeasing someone, and you need their acceptance and approval so badly that you want to go for lose-win. You capitulate and give in, rather than combining courage with consideration. The hard moment of habit 5, seek first to understand, then to be understood, comes when you are crying to be understood. Everyone else is having their say and you are not. Everyone else's feelings and views are being expressed and yours aren't. Besides that, they're off base and you have a much better idea. You matter too. They should understand you. You already understand them, and now it's your turn. Besides, understanding them is irrelevant. You know you're right. There's no need to understand that which is wrong, or so you think. The second hardest moment I face, and the greatest mistakes I make, usually come from violating Habit 5. It's judging before I understand, and it's acting before I really understand either the big picture or another person. Then once the collective monologue begins, you start investing more and more of your ego into your convictions and into your own need to be understood. The other just isn't listening. Oh, what a hard moment that is. To reach deep inside and subordinate your need to be understood, and to really do the work to get into the frame of mind and heart of the other. It is listening empathically and having the discipline and the patience to simply hold your tongue. It's constantly relearning that anatomy lesson that we have two ears and one mouth and that we should use them accordingly. Remember, only one of the three holes closes. The hard moment or test of Habit 6, synergize, comes when you have a difference with someone and you are tempted to simply compromise. It's taking the course of least resistance by trying to quickly and efficiently find some middle position satisfactory to both, even though you know in your heart it does not optimize the situation. You know that there are other unexplored alternatives out there, but there has not been enough Habit 5 practiced to really understand the issue and the underlying needs and concerns of the people involved. In short, the temptation is to satisfy rather than to optimize. The key is to press on in the spirit of Habit 4, using the skill of Habit 5, until the spirit of synergy starts to come into the relationship. Then you are both looking in the same direction. You're both searching for a third alternative, whereby you not only tolerate and accept differences, but actually celebrate them. Creating a third alternative that is felt by each person to be superior to those originally proposed becomes one of the most bonding and binding experiences in relationships and in life. Habit 7, Sharpen the Saw, is essentially the habit that this program represents. It is using our unique gifts and endowments to constantly renew ourselves physically, mentally, and spiritually, and to renew our relationships. In so doing, we counteract entropy, which is the tendency of all things to eventually break down. One of the most effective ways to renew is through daily meditation and reflection in both one's heart and mind. The renewal spirit is stirred. The resolve to live by values based on principles is renewed and deepened. Our batteries are recharged. The saw becomes sharper. Your life becomes sharper. You are able to do your work better, faster, wiser. You are better able to love unconditionally, to take initiative, to be both courageous and compassionate simultaneously. You're able to sidestep negative energy rather than give away your space to those people or things that seem to control or victimize you. When you don't sidestep, you literally give up your freedom to choose your response. You disempower yourself. You empower others' weaknesses to continue to mess up your life. You are not living. You are being lived. Habit 7 has many hard moments. For me, the hardest is to simply get up at 5:30 in the morning and climb aboard that stationary bike and start reading when I don't want to, when I'm longing to get back between the sheets, when the siren call of the mattress is ever so seductive. I've also found that the key to my being strong in this hard moment of climbing on that bike is being strong in the hard moment the night before in going to bed at a decent hour. My next hard moment is paying the price early in the day to develop a frame of mind and heart that's in total alignment with the vision and principles of my personal mission statement, to truly win a private victory. I found that books and programs like Reflections can powerfully serve to create that mind and heart. Reflecting is like priming the pump. The familiar saying goes, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." It takes conscious effort to ponder and meditate, to slow down the rush and the urgency addiction long enough to get some perspective, to ask, "What is it all about, Alfie?" Putting thoughts from the mind into the heart is the very essence of meditation and reflection. Plato said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Yet keeping a journal to observe one's own involvement in life, distilling one's learnings, experiences, feelings, and insights, is a hard moment for many. Turning off the mindless TV viewing and getting back into a challenging, interesting, enlightening, or inspiring book is a hard moment for others. Reflecting and meditating upon principles of effectiveness which deal with all of life is as vital to our mind and soul as food is to the body. Yesterday's meal simply will not satisfy today's hunger. That's why President Bush lost and Clinton won. Each day we must eat. Each day we must reflect. If sharpen the saw truly becomes a habit, a deeply ingrained behavior pattern, just as brushing one's teeth or bathing, and if this habit is done in a balanced, consistent, and wise way, it will affect the quality, the productivity, and the satisfaction of every other hour of the day. Honestly, I know of no higher leveraged activity in life that compares with sharpening the saw in all four dimensions: physical, mental, spiritual, and social. Done properly, all the other six habits are exercised, developed, and used. And when we join others in sharpening the saw, relationships are deepened and bonding truly takes place. It moves the fulcrum over and has exponential leverage and synergy. When I have media interviews on the seven habits, I am often asked the questions, "Do you have any evidence that these are the habits of effectiveness? Do you have any empirical proof? Have studies been done?" I used to answer by giving some evidence, by quoting studies or sharing anecdotal evidence from people's lives. No longer. All I do now is challenge the interviewer to show me one exception, one truly effective or successful person, one truly effective or successful family or organization which violates the principles contained within the habits. By effective, I mean both short and long-term success, and also balance and accomplishment in all areas. That is personal life, family life, work, etc. They simply can't do it. I would sincerely open this challenge to anyone. Sometimes the interviewers say, "Well, what about this obviously successful person?" I respond, "Now remember how we define success. Both long and short-term accomplishment, as well as balance. How's his relationship with his teenagers?" They often respond, "Well, that's in shambles, but his business is really prospering." "Really?" I answer. "Let's look deeper into that business to detect the reasons why it's prospering. Is it possibly because the competitors are dumber? Or because success in the marketplace is relative? Or is it due to a brilliant market strategy or a unique patent position? How long will that last? How strong and healthy is the culture, the goose that lays the golden eggs? Is the trust level high enough so that people are truly empowered to provide consistent quality service to the customer in fast, flexible, focused, and friendly ways?" The habits are founded on self-evident principles which are almost synonymous with the word success or effectiveness. True effectiveness is both long and short-term achievement and balance, rather than just a few golden eggs produced in one area of life today. On my left shoulder is a small scar. I imagine you also have one, on your shoulder or somewhere else. I remember receiving a smallpox vaccination as a small child and getting a bit sick that day. A little smallpox was introduced into my system, but it triggered an immunity so that I never really got smallpox. You probably haven't either. I remember it was a hard moment. It was an unpleasant experience. I feared it. In spite of assurance, I remember the pain. I would have preferred not to have it done. I had no real sense of what it all meant. But my parents insisted, and of course I, like you, am happy that we complied. We had to be strong in that hard moment. In considering the possible alternative, the benefits were incalculable. When we sharpen our saw in a balanced, consistent way, we literally vaccinate ourselves, slowly, gradually, even imperceptibly. An immune system develops within so that no matter what problem we face, we are able to tap into our deep inner resources and reserves. It also cultivates the awareness and the humility to tap into outer resources when needed. We never really get the disease which flow from unsolved problems because our immune system is sufficiently strong to solve them early on. That is the reason why AIDS is such a horrific disease. It destroys the very ability to fight disease. It destroys the immune system. People don't die of AIDS. They die of other diseases because they have no immunity to fight against them. Similarly, individuals don't die from setbacks and disappointments. They die from the lack of a coping immune system. Marriages don't die from in-law problems or financial challenges. They die from not having an immune system, which has been developed by synergistically communicating through such challenges. Strong immune systems enable us to honestly examine ourselves and our relationships with others. They enable us to make amends, to swallow our pride, and to apologize or make whatever other emotional deposits are necessary to heal, to restore, to renew. Each time we make such deposits, each time we reflect and recommit with real intent, literally we inoculate ourselves again, and a new immunity is triggered, which will enable us to handle even greater setbacks or disappointments that may come our way. The key to developing a strong immune system in your family is being strong in the hard moments of showing unconditional love to that child that tests you the very most, who pushes you to the very limit. When such unconditional love, not permissiveness, is shown to this one, every other child knows that he too and she too is unconditionally loved. This knowledge lies at the heart of an intrinsic sense of self-worth and of the abundance mentality. But when love is given conditionally, every other child knows they too have to win their love by good behavior, that there is nothing in them of true intrinsic worth. They then develop their sense of worth and security from outside, from a comparison-based identity. A scarcity mentality is then developed and cultivated, which makes it difficult for them to be genuinely happy for the successes of others, including their own loved ones. They may say they're happy, but inwardly they're eating their hearts out, and they know it. You know, the whole spirit of this approach is one of prevention. So much of our lives as individuals and organizations is spent treating just the symptoms of deeper underlying problems. We are so caught up in the urgency of everyday life that when a problem arises, we immediately treat the pain it is causing, thinking that the pain is the problem. What we don't see is that it is only a symptom of a more chronic disease within ourselves, our relationships, or our organization. For example, though some efforts are being made in the healthcare and medical field to move toward a prevention approach, the paradigm that still overwhelmingly governs is one of diagnosing and treating sickness. Just recently, I underwent a thorough physical examination and set of tests by a good prevention doctor. One of the resulting recommendations was that I have an additional test called a lower GI. When I went to the hospital for the test, the admitting nurse asked, "Why do you want this test? What are your symptoms?" "No symptoms," I replied. "That's not the point. I want to see if there are any problems that have no symptoms yet." "I'm sorry, we don't perform this test unless you have symptoms," she responded. I was absolutely amazed. So I continued, "Isn't it true that many forms of cancer can be cured if detected and treated in the very early stages?" "Yes," she responded, "but we still can't perform the test unless there are symptoms." You can see that the treatment paradigm was so deeply entrenched in this good nurse that it blinded reason and the power of prevention. Reflection and renewal on the four areas of life is prevention. Finally, I believe that these seven habits tap into a tremendous reservoir of new capacities and potentials that lie within each one of us. However, access to this power is not ultimately found by focusing on self, on turning inward, or on self-improvement. The pattern of true growth and development may occur from the inside out, but we are driven to it from the outside in. It comes from the need that all of us have to serve, to matter, to contribute to the lives of others and to society, to solve problems, to be involved in something of transcendent meaning, to leave a legacy. In other words, private victories precede public victories, but unless some meaningful challenge exists outside, some need or cause to serve, there will be no private victory, or at best it would only be self-serving. Browning put it succinctly. There is an answer to the passionate longing of the heart for fullness. Live in all things outside yourself by love, and you will have joy. It is a lesson learned slowly and through difficulty. These habits are foundational. They are generic. The principles are universal. They transcend culture, religion, race, nationality. They are made relevant in situations in the form of practices. Like the blood which flows through the heart into the various parts of the body to be used in specific ways, so too, ultimately, principles must become practices, that is, specific actions. Every person and his or her situation is unique. Therefore, universal abstract principles must be converted into unique practical actions applicable to that situation. The hard moments are in these hard realities of everyday life. But I am absolutely convinced that when we are truly strong in these few hard moments, so unique to each one of us, everything else in our life is essentially cake. The greatest battles of life we ever fight are fought out daily in the silent chambers of our own hearts.